Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Here are two stories from Washington Post health and business reporter Christopher Rowland that will make your head spin. Story number one, the Food and Drug Administration has just approved the most expensive drug in the world. One dose of this drug costs $2.1 million. Hold that thought. The other story is about a drug that has just gotten cheaper, and that's why it won't be tested as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Are you feeling angry about the $2 million dose? Maybe resentful about the research not being done because a drug doesn't cost enough? Well, such is the complex world of pharmaceutical pricing in America right now. Let's take a closer look as Washington Post health and business reporter Christopher Rowland joins us now. Christopher, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
Let's dig into the Alzheimer's story first, because this looks like the one with the most implications for the most people. The pharmaceutical company Pfizer makes an anti-arthritis drug that many people know called Enbrel, and somehow this medication for achy joints got on people's radar as a possible prevention for Alzheimer's disease. How did that happen?
So there's been some research into inflammation and its role in Alzheimer's disease, inflammation that affects the brain. And so some people internally at Pfizer in one of their Pennsylvania headquarters got the notion of, let's examine whether or not people with rheumatoid arthritis on Enbrel are being affected as far as any potential for Alzheimer's disease. And what they found, so they checked insurance claims records, which is called an epidemiological study. They looked at hundreds of thousands of claims with a data analysis, and they found something pretty surprising. And that is that people on Enbrel who had rheumatoid arthritis had a 64% reduced risk of contracting Alzheimer's disease. So that was pretty startling, and it triggered kind of an internal discussion in Pfizer. This all began sort of around 2015.
And I'm going to do the numbers a little bit here because they're interesting, and our audience is not afraid of math. We don't inflame math phobia on this show. We cure it. So here goes. There were two groups of 127,000 people, 127,000 with Alzheimer's disease and 127,000 people without. And it turned out that in the group without Alzheimer's, about 300 people had taken Enbrel for something. In the group with Alzheimer's, only about 100 people had taken Enbrel. Aha! So the question is, could Enbrel have had something to do with not having Alzheimer's disease? But Christopher, that's hardly proof of cause and effect, right? It's not actually that many people.
Right. It's not that many people. And what this is considered in the industry is a signal. So, and what you do with signals is you try to check them out further. And the way to do that in this case would be to conduct a full-blown double-blind placebo clinical trial where people would be compared, people taking Enbrel or injected with Enbrel, and compared with people who are not, and to see, you know, with thousands of people whether or not there is indeed a preventative effect for people not getting Alzheimer's disease. And so that's what Pfizer ultimately ended up not doing that. And that's what has caused some controversy.
So if money was no object, what would happen next in terms of medical research?
Well, I mean, so clearly there's a number of researchers who really want Enbrel checked out to find out whether or not it does indeed work this way and can prevent Alzheimer's. It does appear that, you know, to have this preventative effect, you have to take you have to be on Enbrel in the very, you know, before Alzheimer's starts or in the very earliest stages of having Alzheimer's. It's a complicated situation with inflammation being treated by Enbrel on the peripheral part of your body, in the blood and in this tissue and joints and things. But the Enbrel does not cross into the directly into the brain. And so it's sort of an indirect effect of controlling inflammation and throughout the body and how that then affects cascades down to inflammation in the brain. So it's a complex science. It really needs to be checked out. If money were no object, it would cost the estimate that Pfizer had was about $80 million to conduct a stage three trial in 3,000 to 4,000 people. I've talked to people who say that's actually numbers too low. But it could conceivably be around $200 million would be maybe a more realistic number. And that's what it would take to run a trial on this. It's risky. It might not work.
Do they spend that much on other drug trials? Is that a common thing that Pfizer or other major pharmaceutical companies do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it costs billions of dollars to develop a drug. What's good about this particular situation is that, or I should say $1 billion to develop a drug. In this particular situation, you already know the safety profile. You already know the dosing. You know how it works. Literally hundreds of thousands of people are taking the drug. They're on it. You can leapfrog right to stage three, which would be to test the efficacy in terms of preventing Alzheimer's. So that's why it would be, a much smaller figure. For Pfizer has made, billions of dollars off this drug. They made $2 billion off this drug last year. They have the rights to sell it in Europe. It's $200 million is not out of the question. Mm-hmm. So for Pfizer, what really came down to, they were getting out of Alzheimer's research in the first place. There's been so many frustrating things about Alzheimer's that people are just getting out of it. And big drug companies are saying, we can't deal this anymore. There's too many failures. And then the other thing was that Enbrel is coming off patent, and it now is facing generic competition, biosimilar competition. So Pfizer will no longer have a monopoly price option to charge a very high price for the drug. The prices are going to come down. The pot of gold is not there anymore, and that critics say this decreases the incentive for people to develop drugs or new uses of old drugs.
Because after 20 years, the patent on a pharmaceutical product expires, and then the generics can come on the market and compete for it. Therefore, you say not the profit incentive. Why do drug companies lose the patents on medications they created after 20 years? If I write a book, or if you write a book, you're probably more likely to write a book than I am. The copyright under U.S. law lasts for the rest of your life plus 70 years. 70 years after you're dead, Christopher, your kids will still be the sole people making royalties off a book that you wrote if anyone buys that book. But a life-saving medication only gets you a patent for 20 years. Why is that?
Well, it's public policy. So in the mid-80s, Hatch-Waxman passed, and that was the major generic drug bill that dictates how long patent exclusivity will last and when generic drugs can be introduced into the marketplace. Policymakers in Washington, with very good reason, decided that unlimited patents should not last, and that there should be a greater good that comes from these drugs and make them cheaper. Particularly since a lot of these drugs are developed with seed money from the National Institutes of Health, a federal agency that helps stimulate the research to begin with. So that's another crucial component of this. A lot of drugs are developed, with NIH funding in the labs and universities, and then they transfer their way out into the private sector where they're developed. The private companies make billions of dollars, and then they cycle into generic, and then they're cheaper, and that's supposed to benefit the entire health system.
But when we complain about the high cost of pharmaceuticals and the price gouging that seems to motivate it, the drug companies argue that they need the big profits to have the finances to sink into testing new drugs, because many of the new drugs they test will fail and lose the money in the research process. And we usually sneer at that and we say, oh, that's not real. That's just an excuse for your greed. But is the Enbrel and Alzheimer's story a piece of evidence on their side of that argument?
Well, it's sort of – so Pfizer says that the reason that they didn't pursue Enbrel was because they didn't believe this signal and that the science just didn't hold up. But there's a number of researchers who say, indeed, that could have been pursued, and it's more about markets and the generic issue. And also, Pfizer has another drug coming on the market for rheumatoid arthritis called Xeljanz. And that drug is a pill. It's not an injectable. So it has a lot of appeal for people on rheumatoid arthritis. It's better. It's more convenient to take. But if Enbrel were to show a positive benefit for Alzheimer's, you could see a lot of people staying on Enbrel and not switching to the new drug, which is going to make profit. So there's a lot of sort of market dynamics here. And the thing I think that's frustrating for a lot of people is that, as you just pointed out, the drug companies say we need to charge really high prices so we can do the hard work of, you know, sometimes failing and pumping money into pure science and scientific endeavors. They have, you know, a campaign that says go boldly, where they're going to be bold. They're going to, you know, find cures. And in this case, there is what, you know, critics say there was a clear signal here that was not pursued. And that's what's very frustrating.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls if you have any questions for Washington Post business and health reporter Christopher Rowland. We're talking about a story this week that the company Pfizer is not going to test and had not been releasing preliminary results on the drug Enbrel, which is generally used for arthritis, but which might have a potential use for preventing Alzheimer's disease. And we'll also get into his other recent story about the FDA approving the most expensive drug in the world. But if you have questions for Christopher Rowland from the Washington Post, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or maybe your own N of one story about one of these medications and you, if it really relates to what we're talking about, 212-433-9692. So, Christopher, obviously Pfizer has a right to research or not research a drug, but maybe the even bigger point of your article is that they didn't tell the world about the association between Enbrel and Alzheimer's prevention. So someone else could research it based on this tantalizing clue. So now we're into even darker territory. Why did they keep this association a secret?
So Pfizer says it didn't publish the information. So first of all, we should mention that, you know, drug companies publish information all the time. It's not just scientists at universities. Drug companies do publish information. They do conduct academically oriented research, and they do present abstracts and posters at all kinds of different, you know, conferences around disease and things like that. So in this case, they chose not to, they said, because they didn't think that the science was accurate. They didn't believe their statistical analysis. They thought that it didn't meet the rigorous standards that they expect that they would meet their standard for publication. And that they also didn't want to send any outside scientists down a misleading path. So outside scientists say, you know, this is sort of they don't think that this argument carries water. There's a lot of people who are indeed interested in the link between inflammation and Alzheimer's and that totally understand the potential and the, you know, and also the potential pitfalls of analyzing Enbrel's ability to prevent Alzheimer's disease early in the disease. So it's a number of people are quite upset when I told them, or maybe upset's a bit strong, but they were perturbed that Pfizer hadn't published this, and they wish they had known, and they wish that Pfizer would still actually release the information now.
Is there a law? I guess not, or maybe a code of medical ethics that would require Pfizer to share that potential life-altering news with the world?
It's a very interesting question because, you know, we hear so much about drug companies hiding signals that are negative about drugs, where, you know, there might be a negative side effect of a drug that causes maybe, you know, increased elevation of heart attack risk or stroke risk. And sometimes drug companies have been slow to either, you know, release that information or disclose it or have literally buried it. In this case, it sort of turns that around and says, do drug companies have an obligation to disclose positive information, a positive side effect of a drug? I've talked to ethicists on sort of both sides of the issue. You know, some believe, yes, absolutely, they should disclose this, especially in a disease state like Alzheimer's, where there's been such a frustrating hunt for a cure, a treatment, or a prevention. It's absolutely devastating disease that has really no effective treatment whatsoever. And that, you know, so the company has an obligation. Another ethicist I talked to said that, well, look, you know, we already require that they, you know, disclose all their clinical trials and that they disclose adverse effects. to the FDA, and that, you know, do we really want to start requiring drug companies to, you know, open up all their files? And so it is, there's a it's debatable. I think, you know, no, there's no law that they are required to disclose positive side effects.
Adam in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Christopher Rowland from The Washington Post. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for having me on there.
Sure.
So I was originally using Enbrel for psoriasis, which worked on certain parts of my body, like my face, which was very, very cool. But then switched over to Humira, which is another biologic, which I found a lot of success with. And I just wondering if there's the same kind of effect with the Humira that they're finding with the Enbrel. And I'll listen off there. Thanks.
Thank you for your question. And you do refer to Humira and some data with respect to Alzheimer's prevention too, right?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. So Humira and Enbrel both target the same protein called TNF-alpha, which causes inflammation. So Humira works the same way. In the study that Pfizer did, when they ran the numbers, they also ran the numbers, you know, several different ways against different databases. And they also ran the numbers for Humira. And they did indeed find a similar positive benefit from Humira for preventing Alzheimer's. The wrinkle on Humira, though, is that there was another study that was done that was published in 2016, outside study done by researchers at Dartmouth and Harvard. And this was also a statistical analysis, which basically duplicated the findings on Enbrel, but showed not as strong of a benefit of Humira. So that was a puzzle that remains unresolved. But Humira does act the same way, and it does potentially have, you know, some benefit for Alzheimer's. Again, I want to caution that, you know, I've gotten a lot of calls. People have, you know, saying, should I go on Enbrel now if I'm worried about having Alzheimer's? And I have to tell them, absolutely not. I mean, it's not appropriate. It hasn't been, there have not been clinical tests of this that are significant. And, you know, people are going to their doctors and asking this. And I think that, you know, there needs to be some caution around that.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, the data is not there. The proof is not there. You also mentioned other anti-inflammatories, the so-called NSAIDs, that would be like aspirin and ibuprofen, where maybe there's a little data to suggest something preventive there too. But how would this even work with any of these anti-inflammatories? These findings don't seem to be about treating patients with Alzheimer's symptoms, if I'm understanding you right. It's that people taking these things for other problems weren't getting Alzheimer's as much as other people when scientists look back later on. So what would society do if these drugs turned out to actually be preventive? You can't put the whole world on Enbrel for the rest of their lives starting at age 50.
That's right. And I think that I think, you know, certainly people who have rheumatoid arthritis may want to use those drugs if it did turn out to be indeed true that they had a preventative effect. If you already have a psoriasis or an indication that, you know, so this would give you an additional prophylactic effect of having neurological disease. There's no suggestion yet that people who are, you know, don't have rheumatoid arthritis should start taking it. But maybe you could, you know, there are genetic tests, you know, the people are at higher risk genetically for Alzheimer's. Maybe that would be appropriate. Again, this would be down the road after more clinical trials and more study. It is a very tantalizing signal, that especially since there's been so much failure in trying to target amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's disease, which is the, you know, the clumps of protein material that accumulate on brain tissue and are, you know, a clear direct result of having Alzheimer's disease and is, you know, are the hallmark signature of it. Nobody attacking those plaques has not produced any effect on treatment of disease. So that's why a number of people are shifting their focus to inflammation, and the timing of how do you treat inflammation and when seems to be really crucial. Once Alzheimer's has started, treating inflammation doesn't seem to have any effect, and it's really in a prevention mode right now, I think, that people are interested in.
Here's Dan in Bridgewater calling in, who says he's an MD. Dan, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. I just want to point out that there is a distinction between phenomenological and mechanistic research. And then one, you see a phenomenon like you've just described. And another one, you get at it through understanding the mechanisms by which this happens. And the difference between these are that you may have a short-term effect that's very encouraging, but then over the long term, you have some rather devastating effects. And the kind of research that would be required for this would be so devastating if it doesn't work out. That has a lot to do with why people are not doing this kind of work. So I think it's a little unfair to attack Pfizer for this, even though your main points are absolutely correct about the interest they serve. The real issue, I think, is that we should be putting much more basic science research money to work. And you have so many people with PhDs in these various physical sciences that should be funded and funded continuously at public expense. And
right. And Dan, I'm going to leave it there as you're on a pretty terrible phone line, but I think people got the gist of what you were saying. And I actually want to follow up on what he was saying, Christopher, because reading your article, one question that occurred to me, thinking about how Pfizer, or it doesn't seem like any of the other pharmaceutical companies, are willing to sink the money, the $80 million to $200 million that you estimate a clinical trial would take to figure out if Enbrel or these other anti-inflammatories really do help to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Isn't this exactly the kind of thing that government research is for? If the private for-profit sector doesn't have the incentive to research a drug that could have a ginormous public health benefit like this, isn't this what the government is supposed to spend tax dollars to find out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are people who wish the NIH would, dive into this. In England, there is a trial going on of around 300 people using Enbrel. It's a very small trial, and even if it's positive, it's not going to be won't be conclusive. But that's being funded by a foundation, an Alzheimer's Foundation in the UK. And so it does seem like it's going to be up to, foundations and government entities to if we want to move forward on this particular space. There are a variety of drug companies, more startups and things like that, that are looking at various ways of attacking inflammation in relation to Alzheimer's with, different compounds, different molecules, things that they'll have patents on for 20 years. And so, and another thing that is mentioned, Enbrel doesn't attack what Dan just brought up was that, there's a mechanism and then there's sort of a more general effect on the body and it's sort of this indirect effect. If someone could come up with a drug like Enbrel that could have a different molecule that would pass through the blood-brain barrier and attack brain tissue directly, that could be the type of breakthrough that, government might fund or that could come out of a university and become a new product. But those are the types of big, bold breakthroughs that would have to happen, I think, right now to get sort of this inflammation thing really going.
We have a few minutes left with Christopher Rowland, Washington Post health and business reporter. And your other recent article is infuriating for a whole other reason. The Food and Drug Administration approves a gene therapy that's the most expensive drug in the world. What's the most expensive drug in the world?
So this drug is called Zolgensma, and it's made by Novartis, and it treats a devastating disease called spinal muscular atrophy, which is a genetic disease that affects tiny infants very soon after they're born. Your gene doesn't tell your muscles to stay strong and grow, essentially, and the child can't breathe and ultimately either dies or has to be on a respirator. There are different forms of it that strike later in life as well. And so it's a very rare disease, and now there's a gene therapy made by Novartis. There's a competing drug made by Biogen called Spinraza, which costs around $375,000 a year. So you have this competition for this very small pool of patients between two drug companies charging exorbitant amounts for these drugs. The thing about that Zolgensma, the Novartis drug at $2.1 million, is it's a one-time treatment, theoretically. So that's the plan. It still has been on the market such a short time. Nobody knows absolutely 100% if it will work forever.
We're going to run out of time soon. Why would a one-time treatment of anything cost $2 million?
Because that's what the market can bear, essentially. So that's what people are going to be willing to pay to save the lives of these infants, even if it's 500 to 1,000 infants a year.
You mean it's only because that's what people are willing to pay? Does it cost to produce? How much profit are they going to make on each of those kids for $2 million?
Well, I don't remember how much they spent developing the drug, but yeah, there's a very large profit involved after treating. I don't exactly know the exact numbers, but they ran the numbers, they do the analysis, they try to figure out what is it worth to save a child's life, and there are these metrics about rare disease that if a child has a rare disease that's could potentially fatal, it's worth $250,000 a year to develop a drug to could save that kid's life, or $500,000 a year. And there are these sort of metrics that people use to try to figure out what is a drug worth. Uh-huh. It ends up being somewhat arbitrary, and it's very controversial. But that's how you end up with these exorbitantly priced drugs.
But what happens with regular kids who have this disease? What if you're not Jeff Bezos's kid? Maybe that's the only person who could afford this drug for their kid.
Well, insurance companies and Medicaid are saying they are going to pay it. I mean, it's the disease is so devastating, and this does give families so much hope for their infants that the human need is so compelling that people are willing to pay this price to do this. This is not the type of like the pharma bro who is gouging on a generic drug, goes from $5 a pill to $700 a pill, and that gets at Congress all outraged. This is rare disease that affects, tiny children, and it's so it has a much more sympathetic profile.
So last question in our last minute. Do these two stories fit together in any way? A drug that's too expensive to administer and a drug that's too cheap to research?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And that's really a good question, because what they both point to is that how we fund drug development in the United States is fundamentally based on profit motive and the opportunity to make monopoly pricing and set monopoly prices and make a fortune off of the drug during the patent window. Once that patent window is over, then the incentive to develop drugs and to create cures goes away. And that's one of the major byproducts of the way that our drug system has developed in the United States.
Very interesting stuff from Christopher Rowland, Washington Post health and business reporter. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really, really appreciate it.